Conversations with Apollo, episode number 8. I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. Labar.
In the whole history of man, this has to be the proudest day of our lives. Because of what you have done, the heavens have become a part of man's world.
Mr. Labar, James DeRuvo, how are you?
Hi, James.
Well, I'm glad to have you join me on my podcast today. Have you had a chance to listen to it?
No, I haven't. I haven't yet.
It's been quite an interesting journey for me, being that
I bet it has.
When I, you know, during the Apollo program, those were my wonder years when I was 8 years old.
Uh-huh.
And my son is the exact age that I was during Apollo.
Yeah.
So this has been a lot of fun to not only remember that, but to see it through his eyes as well, which has been really fun.
Yeah, I know, because my son was about 12 at the time. He's now a managing editor of a major metropolitan newspaper. And, of course, he sees it when he writes about it, or he has people write about it. He sees it from a different light than they do. Totally.
I also noticed that you in your bio that you had the absolutely most difficult job in the U.S. Army Air Corps.
you mean a bull terrier, Jonah?
That's got to be the craziest job.
I went out to be a pilot, and it turned out that after the first flight, I couldn't judge the height very well. And they took me back and tested me again and for a depth perception. And I had didn't have very good depth perception. So they essentially flunked me out. And they put you in as a gunner. And then when you're a gunner, they size you up, and the smallest person, and I'm 5'6", so the smallest person goes into the ball chair, and it's a happening. Let me tell you, it's a hell of an experience.
Oh yeah, I can only imagine the.
I remember the first time I went in, my legs were shaking so hard because you feel like you're leaving the airplane completely, which you really are.
Yeah, you're in your own little vehicle.
Totally, completely. And the only thing that ever worried me, of course, there's 250 caliber machine guns at each year, so that'll scare you. And you're sort of bent up into a cramped position. But the problem that I always worried about is that the back of your head is the hatch that you come in on. And if that thing opens, you can't get out. On the one hand, the other is you may go flying. So that always worried me a lot.
And if you get if you get stuck in there, and then the B-17 has to make a belly landing, you're pretty much screwed.
Well, you're sort of wiped all over the runway.
Yeah,
ain't much left of you. I'll tell you that.
Which I've read actually did happen once or twice.
Oh, it happened more than one time. Oh yeah. And the other is that you see something the rest of the crew didn't see. If you're flying over and they're shooting stuff up at you, and you see these black puffs, it looks like it's all coming right up at you, because you're looking right down at it.
Yeah.
And the rest of the crew never saw that. They could see the puffs off in the distance, but to me it looked like they were all aiming for my head. So, it was not an easy thing, and the most amazing part of it is that you had a gun sight that you control with your foot to try and get the thing lined up on the incoming wings, ends of each wing, and you needed depth perception for that. That's what I got a kick out of. So the whole process was, I can tell you the only other thing that I worried about was as you came around, because you can twirl the thing 360 degrees. And as I came around and faced the front of the plane, your guns are pointed right at the engines. And of course they had stops to even though you may have pushed the trigger longer to shoot. They had stops to prevent that from happening, so they would have cutouts and that. But it always scared me as I tracked the plane around and to the front that I was going to blow off one of our engines. And even though I knew they had cutouts, I was always worried about that. So it was a heck of an experience. I was only 19 at the time, so you know, it was a long time ago.
Oh yeah, back those. I'm sure those were. I'm sure you have numerous stories.
Oh yeah, it was over in the Pacific, so that was weird.
Well, everybody who has a camcorder that records their kids' baseball games or video games have my next guest to thank for the incredible compactness of those designs. Stan LaBarre is my guest. During his Westinghouse career, Stan served as the program manager for the Apollo TV lunar camera, which recorded Neil Armstrong's first steps on the lunar surface on July 20, 1969. He also helped develop the Apollo color TV cameras, the Skylab TV cameras, and the TV cameras that were used for the live broadcast of the Apollo Soyuz test project. Stan, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So if it wasn't for you, not only would we not get those incredibly dramatic video broadcasts from the moon, but we wouldn't have any of our videotaped home movies.
Well, I don't know whether you would not have had it. They did not, the camera didn't actually lead the way towards a small camera. What it did do, though, at a time when television cameras the television cameras that existed at the time were only in the studios. There weren't any portable cameras. And these cameras were very much fixed to the floor in the studio in that they couldn't operate outside in the ambient temperature and environment outside, so they needed a controlled environment. They needed very high lights. They couldn't operate indoor. They had to have somebody controlling it at all times and so forth. And integrated circuits led the way for us into reducing the size of those cameras, which are in the many hundreds of pounds and very high power. And when we developed the camera, we had to develop a camera that was very tiny, very light, and had no more power than you would have from one Christmas light bulb, which was about 7 watts. And so to do that, fortunately, we had been doing a great deal of work in integrated circuits. It was in its infancy. And we predicted that we could actually build these small parts or integrated circuits with that took up each one took hundreds and hundreds of transistors and other components, and we could shrink this thing down to 7 pounds is what we had to do. So what we were able to demonstrate is that you could make a very small, compact camera, very light with low power, which would allow you to even use a battery, and that. That indeed, if they could develop the sensor, the type of sensor that would allow them to operate at this very low power, digital type of sensor, then they could actually make something that the public could use, and that's where it came out of. So we showed you could do it, you can do all the functions in the television camera, and I think they gave an impetus to the industry to move out on it, but no one was going to use the Apollo Luna camera for home use, because besides the fact they cost $1 million each, and I don't think Best Buy could even put those on sale. the thing was that this was a real oddball format. It was not the format that you would have on your home television at the time. So the camera was designed to operate not at the 30 frame rate that the home television would operate, but at 10 frames per second. And it had only 380 lines versus 525 lines in your home thing. So it was a non-standard kind of format. And that was done because The television was going to be inside of the telemetry band. And that telemetry band was going to measure all of the astronauts' health and welfare while he was in the mission on the moon, and the vehicle's health and welfare. And all that was going to be transmitted back to mission control so they could track the performance of the astronaut and the vehicle. They only had allocated, or the bandwidth they had left was only 500 kilohertz. Now, you could not put a television into 500 kilohertz. The standard commercial television was using 4 megahertz. So in order to reduce it down and let it, to make it possible to use within that 500 kilohertz space they allocated, NASA had decided to drop these factors down of the frame rate and lines per frame and so forth, and such that it could actually fit within that range. Well, when you do that, you're going to have to convert it, and they put a converter on each of the tracking sites to convert it to a commercial rate, and then sent that on to Houston. So what Houston saw and what Houston transmitted was not the image or not the televisions that came down from the moon, although that was recorded at the tracking site. They had the converted signal, the converted 10 rate to 30 frame rate and so forth, and that's what the public saw, and that's what Houston saw. So by building it that small and that size, it enabled the astronaut to use this thing without, it had no controls on it at all. It was totally automatic, which had not been done in this kind of thing. And it had capability. It had a sensor in it that had capability to see in either lunar day or lunar night. So therefore, they can go, and when they went into the shade, on a moon, the shade is not very gradual. It goes from light to almost total darkness. So since there's no atmosphere, nothing disperses the light. Once you are into a shade, you're in darkness. So within the vehicle itself and on the moon, they wanted to be able to see in both dark and the bright light of the moon.
Unless you're Al Bean carrying the camera.
I'm sorry?
Unless you're Alan Bean who's carrying the camera, then you can't see much of anything.
That's right. So it's that, you know, it was designed. Of course, when you design a camera for the moon, it has another situation it's faced with, or two actually. One is that you're in total vacuum, so you're not in the normal environment the cameras are made for. And two, you're dealing with temperatures that range as high as 250 degrees above in Fahrenheit and minus 250 degrees below when you're in the shade area. So you're dealing with a 500-degree Fahrenheit range that the camera had to operate. Well, this was a little bit more than anything a studio could do, studio camera can do. So it had those features that was designed specifically, one, for the moon, and two, for the astronaut to be able to handle, and all he had to do was set it and point it in the right direction. We gave him, although he had 4 different lenses that he could use, he had a lunar night and a lunar day lens, but he also had wide and narrow, so if he was going to take a long shot, he just put a wide-angle lens and point it in the direction, and chances are he would get what he's looking for, type of thing.
So in the development, I'm just curious, by the time Apollo 11 landed on the moon, color was pretty much a widespread television format standard. What was the why was the decision made to go with a black and white camera for the first few missions?
Well, the thing was started in 1964. That is the program that we were on. We were under contract in 1964. Color television was just in its infancy, and you know it had just started not too many years before. And if the black and white camera was big, color cameras had three sensors in it, not one. These were huge things, big power users, and it turned out that you just could not have made at that point in time or at least in 1964, no one envisioned color television, actually. And it wasn't that until Apollo 10, just before Apollo 10, that we decided that we were very disturbed with the results of the black and white. It was degraded. If you're going to do 10 frame rates, you're going to have to actually rerun one frame three times. And other factors in this, the converter and the noise it generated. So we were not at all satisfied with having been restricted to that particular format. And we decided that the future was in color. And we sat down and came up with a color camera, which we flew on Apollo 10. Now, that color camera was what they call sequential color. You have a color wheel in front of the camera, and you're getting red, green, and blue. And that was really flown in Apollo 10. The truth of the matter was that after Apollo 10 and the color camera was flown, NASA had edicted all future use of television on Apollo would be in color, except for the one on Apollo 11, since it had been so thoroughly tested and had gone through so much evaluation and implementation of, you know, the whole nine yards. And the probability of our taking that color camera we flew in the command module on Apollo 10 and make it into a camera to go on the moon, we only had 3 months, and that was not possible. So we all agreed that the camera that was going to be shown on Apollo 11 had to be that black and white. That camera was the only thing that we had that could be used at that time.
I have just vivid memories. I could close my eyes right now and just envision that grainy black and white image coming off my TV set.
Oh yeah,
it almost looked ghostly.
Yes, it did. And actually, if you look at the if you had the opportunity to look at the image, a 10 frame rate that came down from the moon, as they saw it in the tracking sites, and as they recorded it in the tracking site. Those images were very bright, very sharp in comparison. And it was through, when they did the conversion process, the only technique they had at that time is they displayed the 10 frame rate on a small monitor, and they used a little small 30 frame rate Vidicon tube to look at that face of that monitor, and that in effect converted the image. So you had a very crude way of actually doing conversion. And then in the process to finalize video, they added, unfortunately added noise and whatnot. So the effect was you're actually reading one frame three times. And that, as the astronaut moves, it gives you that ghostly appearance. Because he's moving and the thing hasn't caught up with it yet, so you get a ghostly effect on it.
And I assume that also contributes to the kind, other than the fact that they're in 1/6 gravity, it also contributes to the kind of slow motion effect of them that we saw.
Well, that was the other reason. They couldn't have done that. The only reason they were able to, or they thought that they could do that, when they made that decision, was the fact they knew the astronauts were not going to be moving very fast. Had the astronauts been able to move fast, that would not have been possible. It just couldn't have been. So, there were people at NASA who very much agreed with us that this format was getting close to disaster. It wasn't as sharp as you could have had you had a standard camera. We needed 250 kilohertz more than they gave us to put just a standard ordinary camera, you know, one camera that, not ordinary, but one that would meet the specification for commercial broadcasting at that time. But they couldn't allocate that 250 kilohertz. They just didn't have it. So that's why we ended up with that particular format, on the one hand, it was, the imagery was a little bit, you know, was certainly disappointing of what it could have been. But at the same time, the world did see the astronaut on the moon, even in its ghostly appearance.
I think it kind of, in a lot of ways, it kind of adds to the otherworldly quality of landing on another planet. And
well, that's what Walter Cronkite always insisted. He says if it had been as sharp as the black and white camera television of that time, people wouldn't have thought as much of it as it was in its ghostly appearance. So, it should have been that way, is the way he felt. So, for those of us who were sitting there and had worked 5 years, we were looking at it in two ways. We were looking at it like the world was looking at it. Here was man's first steps on a moon. I mean, this is the first time in the history of mankind this was taking place. But at the same token, we were looking at it with a jaundiced and critical eye of what in the world had happened. what went wrong? So,
I guess it's kind of hard to set that aside when you're looking at the technical aspects of it.
Yeah, you couldn't. I mean, you'd worked 5 years. Keep in mind, we had also simulated it extensively, as it would be. And we flew it on Apollo 9, so we knew what it should look like. We flew it in Earth orbit on Apollo 9. We weren't happy with it, but it wasn't quite what they showed there. But we simulated the lighting as best we could and what have you. There were a number of processes along the way that sort of added to the, it would have been degraded no matter what, even if we were perfect. But you add the conversion and the transmission. And the transmission had to go like 60,000 miles to get to Houston. So that added a little bit of agony to it.
So the television camera did not fly in Apollo 7?
No. The Apollo 7 and 8 was a small Vidicon camera made by RCA.
Ah.
And that was an RCA camera that we were to take over both the... they were on contract before we got in. NASA, the Vidicon 2 did not have enough capability to handle that mission. And it was very limited in what it could do in light range. They made a very nice camera. I don't mean to imply that, but the tube and whatnot was very limited in what it could do. And so we were to take over from Apollo 9 on, and both in the command module and the LM, which we did. So we flew all of the missions up to, and then RCA came back in again. When they had the lunar rover, and their camera was on the lunar rover. And it turns out that one of the reasons, and that was a color camera, and one of the reasons Westinghouse color camera was flown on 10 is that RCA had tried to make or tried to sell a camera that had three tubes in it as the normal broadcast thing, and this was, as we predicted when we went through our own evaluation of that, that it would be very high power and very large in size, and it was. You're building like three cameras in one time, and that didn't apply. So they had to get into the sequential color camera as we developed it. And so when they got into the lunar rover, they turned around and RCA made the sequential color cameras we had and used it on the rover, which was a very nice camera, by the way.
And it was remote operated as well.
Yeah, it was remote operated from the ground. The camera wasn't remote operated. It was on a gimbal that was remotely operated. The camera was just automatically doing its thing. So they had no control over the... Well, he had control, excuse me, I shouldn't say that. He had control over the zoom lens. We had on Apollo 10, we added a zoom lens to the camera. And so they, in turn, added a zoom lens, and when they went remote, they then operated the zoom lens itself. So they had both zoom capability and angle, vertical and horizontal motion of the camera on the Moon rover. So that was an extremely well-done job. What we did was that we flew the first color camera was flown on Apollo 12 onto the Moon, and unfortunately, it was pointed within, I would say, 30, 40 minutes or whatever, it was pointed at the sun and burned out the camera tube.
And that didn't take very long. It was only a few seconds, wasn't it?
Yeah. We were watching it, and when they point, we knew it was going to get burned because he had commented, if you read the comments that preceded, that he was talking about Earth, that he was commenting about Earth, and he never did say he was going to look at, you know, point the camera at Earth, but we knew that the sun and the Earth were 5 degrees apart, and you couldn't look at the Earth without looking at the sun due to the angle of the wide-angle lens. And when he took it and he said something about Earth, everybody yelled, "No, don't do that." And the next thing, we could see this searing take place in the target of the camera. And we knew we had had it at that point. So that was a it was a very very difficult, very traumatic time for everybody. It was traumatic for NASA because here was only the second mission on the Moon, and they had no television anymore. And that they found out that the networks went off. They had no reason to carry it on. Networks went off the air as far as the following the mission was concerned. And the visitor center and mission control emptied out. And here, the only second mission on the Moon, and the interest was gone. And at that point, as I said, it was sort of a blessing in disguise. The television cameras were never considered mission critical. They weren't. And I never argued about that point. But mission critical meaning that whether the camera operated or not, it wasn't going to help or hinder them getting onto the Moon. It had nothing to do with their getting there or going on the Moon. So it was not mission critical. And during the whole process of development, during the period of development of the camera and the development of the Apollo equipment, they had monumental problems they had to solve to get those astronauts to the Moon and bring them home safely. And camera was not high on their list. Their big list was to get the astronauts to the Moon.
As a matter of fact, that was one of the arguments that I believe that that Wally Schirra had about not wanting to take one on Apollo 7.
His problem was the one that was on Apollo 7 had the same format that we used, and he objected to that. He felt that if you're going to have a television, have a decent image, not this non-standard thing that gets converted and kind of ghostly and jerky and so forth. So he was objecting more to the quality than anything. So he objected to using something he felt was not up to what he considered Apollo standards. And so I think he's taken a bad hit on that one. I think everybody misunderstood what he was really objecting to. He wasn't objecting to television. It didn't bother him in the least.
As a matter of fact,
there were times that he felt that the television was interfering with what he wanted to do, and I can understand that because he was trying to make good on what happened during that Apollo 1 disaster. That was his, you know, that was his big thing. So from that standpoint, you know, he just felt there were times when they were interfering. But generally, he really just didn't like the format. And so it was something that created problems, and NASA. At that time, was not negative to television. It just that it wasn't
mission critical.
It wasn't mission critical. We always looked at it that the, I always agreed with him. It, you know, how can you not agree with him? I mean, I agree with that. But our point was that it has its own mission, separate and distinct from everything else on the Apollo mission. It was going to be the eyes that recorded exactly what was going to be there. And that was separated from the from everything else. So it was sort of standing off on a side with its own mission. What happened was that when they got onto the moon, and everything suddenly turned to television, when, you know, the whole mission turned to television at that point. And all eyes were on television. The people on the ground in mission control were on television. The astronaut was asking, and Armstrong was asking, you know, how's the television? And the television became the mission. And that's what they never understood. And so, and for every mission thereafter, television became the main thrust of the mission. For good reason. It was something that could be recorded. The public, the scientists, and everybody else could see. And why not? Otherwise, they had photographs and very small amount of film. They couldn't carry that much film with them. So the camera became, and when Apollo 12 failed, the attitude with regard to television with NASA changed dramatically at that point. It was whatever I wanted. You know, what is it you want us to do? What is it you want to do? So that was the first time that we felt that suddenly the camera came into its own world. And that was carried on through when we did Skylab, and certainly carried through when he did the Apollo-Soyuz mission. And so it of course on shuttle today is, you know, they have five, seven, or eight cameras out there all the time.
Not to mention they've got the new live feeds from the video cameras and the boosters themselves, which is incredibly dramatic.
Yeah, and they, you know, they're wonderful little cameras, and they do tremendous work. But all of it came out of this evolution that took place. So when they got into Skylab, by the way, they had four cameras with them, four color cameras on Skylab that we had originally made for Apollo, and we modified them for Skylab and then built additional ones. But what they did on Skylab is that they would bring a camera down from Skylab every time they came down, 4 months or whatever it was, and we would be preparing a modification to for some testing they were going to do. They needed some modification to, and when they went up again, we'd give them that camera, and they'd go up with that camera and use it again, and then next time they'd bring another camera down. So we all had this thing going on for 2 years on Skylab, continually modifying, updating what they have to meet whatever they were trying to do, and they have thousands of hours of television they recorded on an unbelievable amount. I don't know if it's thousands, but it's certainly way into the hundreds of hours of television that were done inside that Skylab to simulate the kind of conditions they're going to do in building the present vehicle that's up there now. So they, the flying seat and whatever is all done using television at the time. So it became a very big part of the mission itself. Was it mission critical? Yeah, if you were going to do the testing they were going to do, it certainly was. And when they flew, when Skylab, when one of the wings, the solar cell wings wouldn't come out, they flew around it with the command module, used the television camera, zoomed in on it, and found out what was holding it, and then simulated that same condition on Earth, did it in, and then sent it into a swimming pool kind of thing to simulate weightlessness. And the astronauts worked on it down there and came up with a way to undo this thing that was holding the wing in place. So it was all done by television at that time. So television started to play an entirely different role as you moved into Skylab. However, It did play a role in Apollo 14. The way they go is they first go into a Earth orbit, and when all factors are considered safe, they then launch them into a translunar orbit. At the time, they had a difficult time doing a dock operation with the lens. They have to come out of the, pull it out of the Saturn V and then do a dock with it. And when they went to dock with it, it was to the LEM, it was a very hard dock. He had to ram it in. And the concern was that they may have damaged the drogues. So the only thing they could do while they were still in Earth orbit, and they wouldn't give him permission to go to the moon at that point, was that they brought the drogue down, pulled the drogue out in the command module and had the camera looking at it and zoomed in on it at all factors so that Earth could determine whether there was damage to it or not, because if they couldn't use that drogue, they couldn't go to the moon. And they were given the go to go to the moon because of what was seen on television. So the television started to play an entirely different role, you know, by then than it had ever had played before. So, but then again, when we went on to probably the most complex system that was ever put together was when we went to the Apollo Soyuz with the Russians, with the Soviet Union. And here we were going to have four cameras, and all four cameras were going to be completely controlled and selectable as you would do in a studio. And so the remote control could select any one of the four cameras and zoom in, and each one had the zoom capability and so forth. And we were also required to operate inside the Soyuz, and we had to modify the Soyuz in order to put our camera in there. We had to have their electrical system and modify it, and we sent people into Baikonur in order to do that. They went up to their stack and did it. And it turned out that we were going to operate out and then actually transmit from their vehicle, so we had to run tests, and we had people in Star City and whatnot doing that. So it became a big precursor to what was going to eventually be used on Skylab, and not Skylab, the shuttle, the vehicles that go up in the shuttle, and that system was used as the baseline to move into shuttle. So it was a whole new development in that regard, terribly complex, involved two vehicles, the American and the Soviet Union, and also involved our own people in Star City to handle both of these things. And then we coordinated all of the distribution of all that television out of Frankfurt.
So in developing the cameras that you used for the Apollo-Soyuz test project, did you have to keep in mind the multiple broadcast formats between the Soviet Union and the United States, or was that all done downlink down at the
that was all done on the ground. So all of the conversions to the various formats, both for Europe and elsewhere in the United States, and what we used in the United States in taking their television, converting it to our NTSC, was all done on ground. And that is a process that was so well developed and so well known, nobody had to develop anything for that. That was already in place. So that technique had been in place for quite some time. It was just a matter of getting it to everybody that had to be done. So we weren't concerned about it. We used what was there, so let me put it that way.
So you mentioned that in the Apollo cameras, due to the relatively narrow bandwidth that they had available for the television transmission, looking forward to the new missions that were going to be going to the moon and hopefully to Mars, and with the advent of high-definition television, is that going to be an issue?
No, not at all. They've already had that. In fact, I was down at Goddard looking at some of that stuff that they were transmitting in high def, and there's no question, they look fantastic. So when we switch over to high definition, they've already been working that process pretty heavily. By the way, when we got into things like the latter part of when we got into Skylab and when we got into Apollo Soyuz, we were given some at least some decent bandwidth. We were up like 1.5 meg, or, you know, as compared to 500 kilohertz. So we had enough to give a fairly decent image. But what they're dealing with now is far broader than that. And they're up in the high bandwidth stuff now. And they're preparing for it. And they've already, I've seen some rather interesting test stuff that came down from the vehicle. So that's an ongoing thing. So that's not a process. NASA is putting everything they can into television at this point in time. The whole world with regard to television and attitude is so reversed from everything that I was involved in. And I deal with these people at NASA Goddard. I deal with Dick Nasca, who heads that up at Goddard. He sets up all of the tracking stations and whatnot to receive this stuff and so forth. And he happened to be on duty back in July 20th, 1969. So he has the same history as I have, and he's looking at this as I am with, wow, world sure has changed. So it's interesting to see how it has evolved over the years from a non-critical to up front and center kind of thing.
Well, not to mention that the TV broadcast in and of itself kind of gave it the feeling that it was the world going to the moon and not just in the United States, that
yes,
everybody around the world witnessed it and could take part in it and own it, as it were.
Yeah, it turned out to be, and I always refer to it, and I believe it in some, you know, almost to be that way, the world stopped still at that point in time and watched television. We were getting reports of all the stores that had, and countries that didn't have very much television or stuff, the stores were putting television in their windows, and people in Town Square were many deep in front of these stores. Town Squares were putting up large television sets for everybody, you know, displays for people to see. It went into almost every country. I got letters, and I still get I get emails from people all over the world who were like your son, who was eight years old at the time, and who didn't see it, but their parents or grandparents saw it, and they're just amazed that they were able to see something like that. So if there was any question of was it was seen into the four corners of the earth, it was, in small communities as well as large. And interesting enough, one of the letters I have was some young fellow who's now 28, but he was quite young when he wrote the referred back to the memo that he remember asking his grandparents. He lived in a tiny little town in Romania that was part of the Eastern Bloc, but they were able to get the television thing from Italy. And they sort of took it from Italy, and Russia, of course, didn't want these Eastern Bloc countries to have it. But they were looking at it no matter what. So it was a time where the world came together as one. And it was, I don't know, have you ever heard of the museum?
Yes.
It's a museum that's in Washington. It's closed, but they're going to reopen now in Washington. They're building a big building in Washington, but they had been open. And it's a museum put on by the news media. And they ran something some few years back of what was the biggest event in the 20th century and the most news-breaking event, and it was the what do you call it, on the moon was right there on number one and number two. So it was the big event of the 20th century as far as television and news come. And the news media looked at it was the first time they had a remote of that type, and it was they considered it the pool camera looking at the event, the pool reporter. And all the reporters on Earth, the only thing they had to look at was the television television monitor. And their reporting was done from what that camera showed them. So it was the first time in history it was done on a world scale, which I found rather interesting.
Yeah, and you could also probably say that that, would you say that that is, was your high water mark as far as your Apollo experience?
Without question. That night was something that I would like to say, it was probably most anxiety, tension growing thing that was going on, anxiety. I was a spokesman that had to go on if the thing failed, and I knew that I had to do that, and I couldn't put anything together because I didn't know what happened, and it wasn't just the camera. You had to contend with the transmission, all of the circuitry and transmission that took it to Earth, the receiving stations, their processing of it, the transmission all the way to on ground, and then up to a satellite and back to ground and then to Houston. Any one of those links could have failed, as well as the camera. And the only person that was tagged with this was myself. So I, for 5 years, I know that moment of truth was going to come and hit me. So I can tell you that it isn't something I'd ever want to go do again in that regard. I mean, just something I just wouldn't want to repeat. It was more than one person should have to, but it only lasted a few seconds, and then there was success, and I didn't worry about it anymore. But that was a tremendous a moment in my life, and I think anybody who was involved with it personally would probably look at it that way. I don't think you could have done anything that would affect your memory of events. And certainly a high point for me. Yeah, no question.
And what was the most frustrating or lowest point in your Apollo experience?
Well, I think when Apollo 12 failed, I think that was a time I had to go on, and I did. And we had a big discussion between myself and the people at NASA because they had put out a release that said the camera failed. And I said, no, the camera didn't fail. He pointed it at the sun. The camera was in good shape. It wasn't done by the camera failing. It was done by it was inadvertently pointed at the sun, and I didn't care for that. And I told them point blank. They kept insisting I go on television. And I told him, no, not until you put out the proper release. And things got so intense that they finally did. And when they put out a release, it said the camera was inadvertently pointed at the sun. I went on world television and talked about it. So that was a tough one, kind of low point for me. The other really two low points. The other one was having to deal with that format. That was a tough one all the time because we knew it was not going to be as best as it could be done. You could do much better at that time, and you knew that it was not going to be it wouldn't be the quality you would have expected. And I agreed with Shira in that case, and others at NASA felt the same way. It would not be the quality of performance of a piece of equipment that you would have expected out of the Apollo program. And I agree with them in that. But we never were able to get anywhere with it. Rather interesting thing, by the way, and one that over the years we've all wondered about, is that so many people have written science fiction about going to the moon. Oh, that has gone on since 1800s or something. And certainly in modern times, they've had movies, they've had everything. And nobody has ever have taken this point in time of the first person going to the moon and the whole world looking at it on television. There's never been a sci-fi story or movie or whatever that predicted exactly what happened, which I find very interesting.
I'm just curious about one thing, though. When the camera came down on Apollo 11 and the first images were upside down, did your heart get stuck in your throat?
No, because there was a switch that had to be thrown. And the only reason it was upside down is the only way we could put it in this, mounted in the mesa where it was sat at, where it was looking at the ladder, the only way we could mount it was upside down. So we had to send somebody out to tracking stations, and they had just a simple switch, you know, up and down. And they had to throw the switch twice. Once when, to make sure the switch was in the upside down position, when the mesa came down, the camera staring at the ladder. The second time was when Armstrong had to pick the camera up and turn it over. Now it ought to be right side up. So they had to throw the switch again. And I was listening in on the traffic that was going on around the world. And I've been hearing these people telling these tracking people, make sure your switch is in the right position, throw your switch. And I said, these guys, I can almost vision it, envision it, that they were flipping the switch back and forth every time somebody told them to throw the switch. I said, it's going to come up upside down. And when it did, we all sat there and sort of laughed at it and said, see, we've been saying all along that they stand on their heads in the moon. So, no, it was more comical to us than anything. But we knew they'd straighten that one out real quick. And by the way, anytime you ever see it on television, they never show that part of it anymore. They just cut that out.
Oh, I remember it. That was one of the that's one of the joys of live TV.
Yeah, right. Wasn't it though? We got a kick out of it. I see that guy's climbing up from the bottom. Yeah, it was fun. That was fun. I agree with you. That was no doubt a high point of any of us that were there that night or worked on the thing. And I think from the people who worked on it with me, all of the people worked on it, it's very rare that you work on something of that complexity and whatnot, that you have the opportunity to see it operate and see it operate in such a monumental set of circumstances. So they got a great joy in it. And we had a reunion, a 36th-year reunion, first time we ever had one, on the 36th anniversary of the thing. And we had 250 people who worked on it, came to this thing, all quite aged by this time, and remembered vividly everything about whatever the problems were and what they did and so forth. It became imprinted in their mind, I think. So it's rather interesting to see them and hear them after all those years, still remember every aspect of it, without doubt.
So where do you, I mean, obviously with high definition, but are we pretty much out as far as we can go?
Oh,
as far as with using television to cover an event like the Apollo program?
I don't think you can predict that. I think they're going to have television certainly capability beyond anything we've had. Although they've done a remarkable job with what they've had. If you've seen any of the stuff from Shuttle, it's been quite good with those small cameras. But I don't think you can predict television too well. Nobody has predicted very well up to now. So the prediction on this stuff, you don't know with all of this work that's going on between the Internet and television and what you're going to have in the future is anybody's guess. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So I it's hard to say. I think. Don't forget, as far as the high definition digital television, you're back in the infancy again. So you don't know where that's going to go or how it's going to be or whatever. That's yet to come. And let me give you an example of how fast technology goes. My father was alive and read about, as a young boy, the Wright brothers' flight in 1908, first flight. I think they went 120 feet or something of that thing. and some like 66 years later, or whatever it was, 60-some years later, they flew 500,000 miles back and forth to the moon. Now, that's within one person's lifetime. Now, if you can go from 120 feet of powered flight as your first powered flight, and 60-some years later fly to the moon and back, what do you think is going to happen over the next 50 years? Who can predict it? Who could have predicted in 1908 that you'd be flying to the moon with a vehicle that's being launched by a huge Saturn V?
Much less watch it live on TV.
Yeah, and watch it live on television, which they couldn't even envision in 1908. And done by a couple of bicycle manufacturers, by the way, or people have prepared bicycles. So,
it's the great irony.
Technology as a way of moving, at super, super speed. And the faster we develop, the more we develop. So I don't think you can predict what television will be 50 or 60 years from now. It's just not, I don't think that's possible.
Well, let's just hope.
And I've read all the predictions from the 30s and the 20s and whatnot, and nobody's predicted anything. We were going to be flying helicopters around our house at one time. But no one's ever predicted the kind of things that we really have today. And television was not something that was predicted. Certainly, no one predicted the Internet, although we had Internet long before it's being used the way it's used today. We used the Internet back in the 60s to do our thermal vacuum testing analysis, and we've used the Internet to run the programs at MIT to do that. So we had Internet. We had no priority, so we would do it at 3 o'clock in the morning. But there was an Internet system out there that was being used. Who predicted back then, when we had the Internet, that you'd have what you have today on the Internet? And that ain't that many years ago. That's like almost 37 years ago. So I ain't very far.
Much less conducting an interview over the Internet like we are now.
I beg pardon?
Much less conducting an interview over the Internet like we are now, because I am calling you.
Absolutely.
I am calling you using an application called Skype,
yeah,
which uses the voiceover
that.
IP, voice over the Internet, to actually make this recording. So.
Sure.
Who knows where we're going to be? Yeah. It could be the next live broadcast from the moon. Will not be to TVs mostly. It'll be to the computers sitting at our desks.
If you watch the Apollo 13 movie, one of the best sights I've seen on it is what they're saying to the people standing around in mission control. I've got to have that information now. I want to calculate it. I want it right now. And they all pick up their slide rules.
Yes.
Calculate. And that's what we had. We had slide rules at the time. So I didn't have computers. We were working with slide rules. So, it's only a matter of 30-some years what things have changed. So if you want to predict, I'll leave it to others to predict where these things will go. But I won't be around to see them, but I don't believe it will happen the way they predicted. And nobody else has ever predicted anything.
Well, let's
if you couldn't predict that people were going to stand here and watch man's first step on the moon when you had television, nobody ever predicted that. And I think that's rather amazing to me.
So what is this, your post-Apollo career? You are the manager of the Planet Walk program to create a linear solar system museum?
Yeah, well, I did that, and NASA joined me on that. The idea was this, is that I had taken over, there was an organization that we'd set up to do some things on a trail, on a bicycle trail. This is an 11-mile bicycle trail that runs through the communities and all. And the idea is, what can we do on a trail to add some interest to it and so forth and so on. So we came up with a number of ideas. One of them was to do a solar system on trail, which has been done on numerous trails, by the way, is nothing new with us. But usually they were markers put in, scaled down to the proper scale and so forth, the distance and so forth. And they would say Mars and so forth. And we said, no, let's do something different. Let's make a small museum sort of area for each one of these things, display, where each planet would be, have a piece of artwork that would have some significance with regard to the particular planet that we're talking about, have information around for the public to get a better understanding of that planet on one side, and on the back side of it, what we wanted to have were some information of a more scholarly level. So if somebody really wanted to get into it, you go on the back side of these information boards, and they got all of the details as to the size and features about it, and also all the calculations you need about their orbits and so forth and so on. And each one of these things would be open to the public. They would be sort of semi-enclosed by the thing. NASA came in to do all the displays for us. We hired an artist from Texas who now lives here permanently and has been doing them. And the first one she did was on the sun, was a 20-foot stainless steel thing with a big ball on top that was actually, what is it again? Why can't I think of it? You'll have to excuse me. At my age, at 82, I do forget things once in a while. The kind of thing that you can put light through, and it was a little prism. She put in these very, there were 52 prisms sticking out and like spikes coming out. They were big as baseball bats. And as the sun came over, they would then, of course, break out the light into the spectrum, and you'd get the spectrum changing all over the ground in front of it.
Oh, how dramatic.
That, yeah, and that's beautiful. And then we had a guy who is chief scientist at a college, and he was taking these things and trying to put them into an educational thing. Our intent was to educate the youngsters on the solar system, because that's going to be what they're going to have to contend with in the future. So we had a guy who says, okay, if we got light and we got color, then we ought to talk about the eye and how the eye perceives light and so forth and so on. And there were all kinds of features on everything that you can do that you can then turn it around to an educational process. And he worked with NASA, with their people at NASA, and they came up with this format that we were using and whatnot. We still have it going on. We haven't finished it yet. The whole thing by the time we're through, it will probably cost well over $1 million to have been completed between the artists and whatnot. But all of the work being done by NASA to create these signboards is being done. Of course, they're contributing that. But we have these signboards being made by the same people who did it for Disney World. And they're doing it in all these amazing colors and Lord knows what else, techniques that they have. So it's really quite special. And it's been a joy to work. I mean, I've learned more about planets than I ever wanted to know.
And where can people find out more information about the Planet Walk?
Well, it's they have a website, or they did have a website that I haven't visited recently, and I don't know what condition it's in. But they didn't have a website for the Planet Walk. They had a website for the Friends of the P&A Trail, and in it they had the website for the information on the trail. So the next one, or the one that they had, they're just finishing, is the last planet, Pluto.
I'm glad to hear that you still refer to it as a planet.
Yeah, well, you have to come up with, you see, you can come in for either way. You come in either through the sun or enter in through Pluto. And so we had to come up with something. We say that, well, if you are coming from outer space and visiting and coming into this area, here's how you would enter our solar system and so forth. So they're going backwards. but we created this thing that we have. One of the things where we've worked with the midshipmen right here in this area, and we're near Annapolis, and we've talked to the Naval Academy, and when we're ready to have this thing all done, where we need people to take people around, and they've offered the midshipmen to help us do that kind of thing because they feel it would be beneficial for them from a scientific standpoint to do that kind of thing and learn more about the solar system by doing that. So we think that would be a pretty nice deal. The other thing we've been working on, and we've been working on it now with somebody in Pennsylvania on that, is to how do we handle blind children from schools? And how do we convey the information to them, to the people, to youngsters that don't have sight? And there are people who are working on that with us, and we will change our signage when the time comes, once we're convinced that that would be workable and appropriate. It's very difficult to deal in that world if you're not someone who is experienced in that world, and you can do things wrong and not recognize it. So we're being very cautious about what we do. But that's one of the things no one has ever done before on one of these planet walks, is make it so that the blind children could visit it as well. So we hope so someday to have that done. But that's one of the things in the future. So it's an ever-expanding thing is what I'm trying to say.
So looking at their website, people can find out more about the Planet Walk at www.friendsofaatrails.org.
Yeah. I don't know if it's .org or not. I forget. It could be, but I don't think so. I don't think it was .org.
Well, that's what it says here. I'm looking right at it.
Is that right? Did it say .org?
Friendsofaatrails.org, and this is the Anne Arundel County Trails in Severna Park, Maryland.
Yeah, that's it. You got it.
There you go. Well, my guest has been Stan LaBarre, the program manager of the Apollo Lunar TV camera, and all of us owe you a great debt to the history of the Apollo program. Stan, thank you for joining us.
And thank you so much.
You've been listening to Conversations with Apollo, a weekly podcast for space history fans everywhere. For more information, visit our MySpace page at www.myspace.com/conversationswithapollo. Or you can leave us feedback on our iTunes website. And if you know anyone who worked on the Apollo program who has a story to tell, we want to hear it. Just have them drop us a line at apollotalks@gmail.com. Theme music is from Gemini 5, courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network. The song is Babylon Rockets. Visit them on the web at www.gemini5.com. Conversations with Apollo is a copyrighted podcast under the Creative Commons license from Quindar Entertainment. Copyright 2007.